I'm a Canadian, but I've been living in the United States for 20 years and had a weird history that has landed me into the position now where I have a little group that is doing visualization for space exploration. So we, on ordinary laptops and computers, we make models of lunar rovers that will one day trundle the lunar surface looking for water ice and things like that, and visualize astronauts that are doing training and repairing the station and things like that. And so that's, my head is always in a virtual world, but it's in outer space. So I live in cyberspace and outer space all the time. So if you'll excuse my spaciness. One of the projects that I did 10 years ago is a project called Biota. And what Biota did was to try to bring together a community of paleontologists and early life people who think about how life started on the planet with artists and computer scientists who think that they can start life inside computers with software. It's one of the things when you get your hands on that keyboard on the Altair in 1975 and you're flipping the switches and you think, this is a magical little machine. I can make a whole space in here. I could make a reality. You know, I could create life in here. Of course, compute space is pretty narrow and pretty fragile. But one day it may happen. One day we may wake up and log online and there's a very simple living thing there. And it may not be just Google's latest search virus or whatever, but it may be something that biologists say, oh, this thing is autonomous and it's evolving and we better give it a Latin taxonomic name and study it. But I'll come back to that later. What I want people to do at the beginning of this is, now there's a danger here, because when you ask an audience to close their eyes, some of them just go straight off to sleep. If you could close your eyes and visualize the following, and I'll try to describe it. Visualize that you're in blue water, and that this water is kind of a silvery tint to it, and it's kind of warm, and there's a worm, and it's a flatworm, and on its back is a kind of silvery structure, sort of a filigree structure, like kind of like fish bones, but not really. It's almost like paper, and it's undulating through the water, moving up and down and up and down. It sometimes comes close to the surface and it feels the sunlight. The other times it sort of hangs on the bottom where it's actually eating all the kind of detritus of the ocean floor. And as you visualize this, if you can kind of try to tuck yourself inside this worm, this flat worm, and think of it not as sort of a heebie-jeebie thing, something to be afraid of, but think of it as a comfortable place to be. And think of yourself undulating your body as though you're this worm. And you now have, you're in a world of chemistry, because you don't really have much vision. You can kind of tell where the sunlight comes in and kind of tell temperature where the bottom is. But you're sensing every molecule that brushes by your body. And you're sensing the warmth of the sun above as you get close to the waves. If you can put yourself into this creature, into this being, one of the amazing things is this is you. This is you 600 million years ago. And why do we know this? Because that beautiful silvery filigree on the back is the first backbone. Everything that has a backbone came from that beautiful silvery worm. It's your ancestor. If you go inside that worm, each of its cells is a nucleus, and in the nucleus is a pile of DNA, maybe about 2 billion base pairs. And your base pairs that are in your body now, there's a chunk of them that were inside that creature, that little guy. That is you. That ancestor belongs to you. There's a direct lineage between that worm and all the creatures that came in between. There was something called a fish that came from that learned how to breathe seawater and had urine so it could pee and get all the salt out of its body. Then there was a fish that climbed up on the land. It's called a tetrapod. And it tunneled under the land and it ate the ferns and things like that. That's your ancestor. And that little tetrapod, that little climbing fish, survived in incredible odds to become you. And there's a chain that goes up, and you've all seen it in school books. But those creatures, there's a piece of them in you, and it's information, and it's the code that has lived in their bodies in that DNA is in your body. It's unchanged. It's not changed in 600 million years. Going back further, that creature wasn't a silvery fish. It was a single little thing with a cell wall. It was moving around. And it had half a billion base pairs. It's, you have in your body pieces of that. That's still your ancestor. That's 2 billion years ago. So that's the lineage that you have, a personal, you belong. They belong to you, they're inside of you. And so one of the interesting things is, Daniel talked earlier about DMT being produced in the body. When you get it, how many people, say you have had a lot of cappuccino or other things, or you've had a fantastic conversation with somebody that's gone on all night, and you close your eyes. Do some of you see like a trip? You see like landscapes and stuff because your brain is so stimulated, and it doesn't mean that you took anything. Well, it turns out that people who, shamanic experience, that people who can excite themselves to high levels, have a similar sort of vision of the universe. They see the DMT creatures that Terrence McKenna talks about. This is very, very common. They can do it without taking anything. They're actually exciting the fluids around their spinal cord and that fill your brain. They're exciting that with something. They're doing it themselves. And in What to Bleep, in the film, in the book, what you saw was this wonderful pump called the hypothalamus is pumping away, and it sends those chemical messages and it changes you. And What the Bleep's message was, if you have a feeling about something, you change your entire body. Your body chemistry changes in a very, very short period of time because of this pump that starts pumping to change you and send all these messengers up. But around your nerves, there's DMT. Now, one of the interesting things, if you actually have your spinal fluid tested, and this is do not do this at home, your spinal fluid is tested, that you can measure the levels of that in there. One of the ideas that have sort of come to us in the last few years is perhaps you're all DMT beings, and what you're doing by exciting yourself is you're producing more, but you're also lowering the threshold of the buffer that's always taking it up. Because as an animal out in the woods, you don't want to be on a DMT trip. As you see the tiger come to you, you want to be able to run. Other chemicals are needed. But in the shamanic experience or in the caffeinated experience or such, you're allowing yourself to not buffer that DMT that your body's making already and allow yourself to fall into the experience. And it turns out that I have a ridiculously high level. I'm a, what people call a hardhead. I'm very, very high level of it. That's what Sasha Chogan says. That's a sort of a problem. But I tend to be able to do that, to go into that DMT type of experience if I can excite myself to certain levels, maybe looking at Gale. So that little swimming creature, one of the things that came with that backbone was the factory that made DMT 600 million years ago. And everything about organisms then, your ancestor, was about the curving and the moving of that backbone. There really wasn't a brain. There wasn't a body per se, no limbs. The whole being was this little beautiful curving, swimming thing. So in a sense, when you're an embryo, when you're in the uterus, when you're very early embryo, you turn into this puckered little curving being. Everybody starts that way. It's not just some theoretical thing about 600 million years ago that you are. You were in your mother's womb, this little curving being. So really it's reduced to that. And if what's reduced is that the spinal cord, the channel, has DMT and it has all these other, it's the package that you were sent into the cosmos with. Now there's a second package that you have that's attached to you, and it's up here, and it's kind of this bizarre extension of the backbone, because creatures needed backbones always. They were really useful, but a lot of them don't have a whole lot of stuff up here. So this is like a bloom, this is like a fluorescence, or a flower or a mushroom that has grown on top of this basic unit, basic package. It's called the brain. And this year, it's all the psyche in the brain. Did you know that in your brain, if you try to follow all the dendrites and neurons all the way through, you can follow all these pathways? And indeed, in scans, people do brain research, There's all these waves of signal that go back and forth and reverberate and whatnot, go from region to region. But these pathways, an individual electron or chemical charge can actually take this beautiful circuitous route to the brain and go from one side to the other and just keep bouncing around. And those pathways, the numbers of them outnumber, if you count them all up, if you could, it outnumbers the size of the universe. It outnumbers every particle, I'm talking subatomic here, that make up the universe. So what has happened on top of your spinal cord in 600 million years or so is the evolution of a thing that is big enough to contain the entire universe. All the information about the universe can be represented here, not all at once. It would be like Johnny Mnemonic blowing up in the movie, right? Just forget about it. But you're carrying around this machine that is a renderer. Now, any of you in multiplayer gaming or like 3D gaming, you know, that's a world where rendering, the height of silicon technology is rendering these worlds on the screen to drive your brain as fast as possible with as much detail as possible. But the brain's taking that in and it's rendering too. But indeed, when you're in an elevated experience on a trip or you're doing a kind of this induced trip on yourself, and you see these wondrous things, well, guess what? The renderer that's sitting right here is capable of representing more information than exists at any one time in the universe. So it's capable of carrying a signal or carrying a projection, rendering it to you visually or however you take it in. It's like the movie theater that can show literally the entire Douglas Adams end of, you know, life, the universe and everything. You have it. But as a sort of a fragile, energy-limited being, you can only get little bits and slices of it. So in a sense, if you sit out on the playa, you kind of lie down on the playa and you open yourself up, and you're in an elevated state here already, you're in a contact high with all the people who are here who are just, you can feel it. I mean, stuff is happening fast, someone shows up that you're looking for and you weren't even looking for them, and they take you to another camp, and there's a serendipity machine going on here. There's neural pathways going on here. It's real important to make eye contact with as many people as you can, because when you do that, you know, we're afraid of making eye contact for the most part in the outside. We don't do it because we're uncomfortable, we feel uncertain, or are we communicating a message and whatnot. Here you have permission. When you make eye contact, you're going through the primary portals of everything that you are, and you're putting a little bit into someone else, and they're putting a little bit back into you. So it's no shame in doing it. It's a net positive, and that's what creates the brain, that is this great big blobby brain that is now Burning Man in the year of the psyche. But coming back to some other things on how amazing human beings are, that silvery fish thing. Okay, here's a bigger question. What about the brains outside? What about the brains other civilizations? We always think that they're here, right? We think that they're here already. They're making cross circles. They're doing something. We want communication. But how rare are we? How rare are they? Do you have watery worlds like Earth in other solar systems with little swimming silvery things in them now? Because we only have one data point. We only know about life that exists in a nice watery world. A world that can have liquid water and lots of it, frozen water and vapor water. That's what we understand. So not thinking of silicon beings or whatnot, how common are they? Well, one of the things that has come out in the last 20, 25 years is that to the astonishment of everyone, you know, you talk about, well, we've got galaxies with billions of suns, and so therefore there must be lots of life, right?